It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, this hour giving you some local perspectives on the crisis in Ukraine. My first guest is Dean Bakopoulos. He's a writer in residence at Grinnell College. He grew up in the Ukrainian immigrant communities of the metropolitan Detroit area. He grew up speaking Ukrainian. In fact, his first novel, Please Don't Come Back from the Moon, is set in a Ukrainian-American neighborhood in Detroit, and it's currently being adapted for the screen. Dean Bakopoulos joins us. Hi, Dean.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Your family came to the United States as refugees from Western Ukraine. Let's start with the origin of your family here in the U.S., coming from the Ukraine as immigrants. What drove them out?
Sure. I have a very Greek name, but my mother's side is from Ukraine, and my maternal grandparents, about 5 months after they were married, they were in their 20s, the Bolsheviks, Stalinist forces came into the villages of Western Ukraine, and it was basically one massacre after another. So they had to flee in the course of the middle of World War II in 1944. It was already a region in chaos. And the stories they tell are of fleeing into the woods at night, and those who could keep running kept running. My grandmother was pregnant at the time with my mother, and so this is kind of how my family started, was on the run as refugees. Eventually, after landing in a Nazi prison camp for several months, a labor camp, they were freed by American forces and lived for a few years in a refugee camp, but a very harrowing beginning to that.
I'd certainly like your reflections on the present day and to help us understand the feelings of Ukrainians toward Russians. But take us back to fleeing again from Ukraine. What were the stories? What is a story that sticks out that your grandparents told you?
Well, I remember my grandpa was a great storyteller, and he didn't want to make them too dark for me. But I do remember every so often he would tell us the story of what it felt like to see his brothers killed. He had brothers killed by Russian forces coming to the village, basically in front of the family, and there's stories of the village that he would tell of seeing people buried alive, of seeing people who had been shot but had not been killed. My grandmother had the same on her side. These were big village families, so lots of siblings. But almost every family in that village had seen a rather horrific death of a sibling or cousin or a parent. These were villages that were resisting the communist takeover of Western Ukraine, of the small villages. And, most of these people who were my grandparents' age in their 20s had also lived through the famine in the Ukraine in the 30s, in which millions of people starved to death in a Stalin's collectivization of the farms, the forced famine. So it was really a childhood in which, this generation, my grandparents' generation, would have grown up in kind of constant fear of the bloodshed that the Russian forces were capable of. In these very remote villages, it's hard for us, I think, as Iowans, to understand how that would feel to be in these kind of idyllic agricultural farming villages, but be under the constant threat of really kind of barbaric bloodshed. So it was this pastoral setting, looked very much like, the area of eastern Iowa with the hills and the fertile trees and the barns. So this very pastoral setting that was kind of under constant threat.
Do you have, leaping into the present day, do you have friends or family over there now, perhaps involved in the protests, what we're watching on our television, on our internet screens?
I do. It's fairly distant. My relatives in Chicago, my cousins in Chicago, and my godmother, they go to Ukraine often, and they, had a second cousin killed in the protests. My mother's friends, are in Detroit still. There's a lot of new immigrants from Ukraine in the Detroit area, people who are here to work. And they're hearing, of course, stories of the children of their old friends who have been killed in the protests. So it's kind of, it's a small world, and you quickly hear, I think, from other Ukrainians who are here, of the information of people who've been killed, the protesters who've been killed. These are not radical activists who've given their lives to a cause, for a long time. These are, in the case of my godmother's second cousin, this is a father of two, a husband, a working person who went to the protests. So this is kind of surreal that this can happen so quickly, that citizens protesting can be kind of gunned down by their own government.
I think what surprised some of us here in the West, and perhaps you too, but perhaps you can tell us why it isn't a surprise, that these protesters were very vehement, very solid in their resistance to the former government in Kiev, willing to lay down their lives. Is it this history that you've described behind that in part?
I think so. I think that if you are from a Western Ukrainian cultural background, you already know the stories. There's this mythology in your family of the horrific things that your family has survived. And frankly, it's always has been in the last 100 years at the hands of kind of Russian forces, a Russian dictator. And so because these mythologies of violence, of kind of unspeakable acts are so much a part of family lore and history, people remember the brother who was buried alive, the sister who was taken away by Bolsheviks. I don't think there was any doubt in the minds of the people that this was not just going to be a symbolic protest. I think they probably knew as they gathered on the square that this was not going to be won simply by civil disobedience. And I think there was a fearlessness that unless they went, you know, totally over the line and made this as powerful and, yes, I think a violent protest as they did make it, it would not work. And so they were really kind of taking up arms. I mean, it was a revolution more than a protest. And I think it's those stories in the family, those motivate people to understand that the stakes are very real.
How did that affect you personally as a Ukrainian-American watching that uprising?
You know, I think for me, it reminded me so much of just the stories I heard of my grandparents and the resistance in their little village in the 40s, that I felt this instant emotional kinship. And I felt this incredible awe at the strength of people who are willing to go into a place that is dangerous, that where people are dying and continue to protest. It made me wonder if, you know, as an American, I've gotten very used to safe protesting. I've been in large-scale protests myself, but I've never felt really under the threat. And I think one thing it made me think about is, would I be willing to do that? Mm-hmm. Would I have had the courage to be in the square? I'm not sure I would have, as much as I would have believed in the cause. And so, yeah, from afar, you feel incredibly inspired by the bravery and also a little bit embarrassed by the fact that you probably wouldn't have the same courage.
What is your reaction to the images we saw of the sharpshooters shooting unarmed protesters in Kiev?
Oh, it's so horrific just to understand that, you know, orders can be given to so easily to shoot to kill people who are trying to make change, trying to have a democratic expression of civil disobedience. And so seeing the sniper fire, I think, was maybe that kind of images of the bodies were really something for Ukrainians that is such a part of our history books of, you know, and unfortunately for many cultures, it's part of their history books of just these long rows of bodies laying there have been laid to waste by, you know, government forces. It was chilling. You know, there's no way to say it was anything but absolutely astounding that this could be happening. And I think maybe we're lulled into complacency with these things as a Western nation, that these things don't happen so much in the West. But this is a European country. And I think that for all Americans, whether Ukrainian Americans or not, was part of this sort of shock of seeing this. Because I think we want to say that, oh, this would happen in a country maybe that's not closely aligned with NATO, or something we might consider part of the developing world, or something that we might consider the territory of religious fundamentalism in other countries and other continents. But this was very much, you know, a forward-moving Western-style democracy, or at least that was what they were trying to build there.
If you've just joined us, my guest is Ukrainian-American Dean Bakopoulos. He's a writer in residence at Grinnell College. He grew up in a Ukrainian immigrant community in the metropolitan Detroit area, grew up speaking Ukrainian, and actually used it as the basis for his first novel set in a Ukrainian neighborhood, a Ukrainian-American neighborhood in Detroit. Dean, what do you make of the Russian perspective put out there that this action by the Russians into the Crimean Peninsula for the meantime is there as a defense to defend against an unlawful takeover of the government in Kiev and to defend the Russians who are, I think, to 70% to make up the population of the Crimean Peninsula?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I probably don't have the most rational perspective on that, so it's probably more of an emotional perspective. But I think it's quite common for people in power to use military force and then say it is for the good of the people to get involved in another country as a excuse kind of to get involved in another country. Oh, we're defending everything, we're keeping social order. I think it's a definite violation of national borders of a sovereign nation, and it's meant to intimidate and kind of let people know that the Russian army is not going to respect the will of the Ukrainian people. But the Russian Putin has lost a tool, really, a puppet government, somebody who was going to do whatever he wanted in a rich, resource-rich nation, strategically located for energy and agriculture and a lot of financial benefits to that region are in Ukraine. So this is, you know, really at the core, it's the attempt to control wealth.
And yet though, the Ukrainian president was ousted in a way that was not in keeping with the Constitution.
Yeah, it's kind of fascinating to watch that it wasn't, you know, an election. It wasn't democratically change of power. It was a coup, and you could, you know, that's the way that they're staging it. The Russians are saying it was a coup. It was a violent overthrow of government. I'm not sure it was a coup because the military, I don't think, was necessarily behind it. And we think of coups, we think of, like, the military coups of Greece in the 60s or that sort of thing. But
there are Ukrainians, a significant number of them, who want to keep the closer ties with Russia, who view the current government in Kiev as unlawful, primarily in the eastern part.
Yeah, I think there's always a constituency that goes with what, you know, is known or is a safe link to the past. I think our country has shadows of that in certain pockets where the past is seen as safe and that maybe we want to stay with what we know, the Soviet Russia kind of leadership through power and dominance and kind of fear did lead to some social order, right? And I think that there is, in a lot of countries, always a kind of temptation among a group of people to go back to maybe the politics of fear or the politics of division or the politics of force, because it does kind of give us an artificial sense of social order.
Mm-hmm. But when you tell me the stories of your family, and there are many, many families with such stories about the Soviets, the massacres during World War II, don't Russians perhaps have legitimate fears of Ukrainians given these histories and the animosity because of that history?
Well, you know, I think, sure, I'm sure that the suspicion between the two countries is going to be strong, especially now. But they have a lot of shared culture. They're not very different culturally or religiously, which in a lot of parts of the world becomes really the dividing force that leads to these very long civil wars. I mean, there's definitely tension between them, and there's definitely kind of an ethnic rivalry, I suppose. But there's also a lot of similarity in terms of language and religion and culture that I don't think it needs to be a long kind of standing, unsolvable feud the way we see in other parts of the world. I think that the Ukrainian nation has always tried to get independence, and shortly after they get it, there's been a takeover by a Russian strongman, sort of a Russian dictator. This has happened to them many times in the last 100 years, and so I think this is really a desire for sovereignty. I don't think it's the two fundamental religions going at one another. It's not necessarily even totally different ways of looking at the world. There's a real similarity there. It's really the desire for sovereignty, for self-rule, and for a desire, you know, from my perspective, it's a desire for Ukraine to finally get to join modern Europe and try to make things a little bit better there. I have many friends back in Detroit who have been here working. These are skilled professionals, lawyers, veterinarians, doctors, who now work in the Detroit area as dishwashers, as housekeepers, very menial jobs, because you can't make a living in Ukraine, partly because they have failed to modernize economically. So there's families who, like many other nations on earth, they come here to do manual labor in order to help their families survive back home. Ukraine, I think, feels like it's in a position, or the leaders of the movement to join the EU to come up to those standards, I think, believe that Ukraine is a nation that's on the cusp of this modernization, that it's not hopeless, that people should and could be able to make a living there. So there's this little bit of a difference than we see in other parts of the world where it's kind of a long-standing religious feud, something that's so deep in the culture that it's hard to even understand. I don't feel like this is an insurmountable division, but you have to get people like Putin, who is really just about consolidation of wealth and power. If they're in the equation, it's really hard to move forward.
Dean Bakopoulos, you are Ukrainian-American. You grew up in an immigrant community in the metropolitan Detroit area. Can you give us an idea of how many Ukrainian-Americans there are? Do you have a sense of that?
Geez, I don't know. In my world, everybody was part Ukrainian. My mom always... My mother always had a gift of making every last name into a Ukrainian pronunciation.
So. Even Greek ones?
Yeah. You could change anything. You could make Barack Obama into a Ukrainian name if you're my mother. She's very good at that. I was in such a world where almost everyone I knew was Ukrainian, at least for the first 10 years of my life. It's hard to say, but there's millions of Ukrainian Americans in the country. Cities like Detroit and Pittsburgh and Chicago. Have large pockets of people who've came after the war as refugees, and it's really kind of the dominant mode of the Ukrainian immigrants who are here in the United States has been people who came as refugees and worked in the industry, the steel industry, the auto industry, and kind of built lives here. And it's a fiercely patriotic constituency in terms of identifying very strongly with being American and being very grateful to kind of being liberated and rescued by this country at the end of World War II. Many people came over with nothing from Ukraine like they did from other countries and really found a beautiful life here. But there was always this sense of exile among Ukrainian Americans, this feeling my grandparents, you know, could not listen to certain songs without tearing up. There was a constant missing of a homeland that you were forbidden to return to. Under Soviet rule, there was just no way for my grandparents to go back. They were terrified still of going back and being jailed as resistors. So it's a weird relationship with a home country you leave and know you can't go back to for as long as these people were kind of forced in exile.
Even though you grew up here, Dean, in the United States, are there songs, because you grew up speaking Ukrainian, are there songs that make your heart swell, maybe even make you tear up?
There's one that anytime I hear Ukrainian music, I tend to cry just because it was such a part of my childhood. But there was one song that my grandmother used to sing, and the gist of it was, you know, the refrain was, "Mother, I want to come to see you, but I can't. I can't get into the country. They won't let us in. The Russians won't let us in." And she used to sing that song. I mean, I think there was a real sense, these people left behind, you know, aging parents and young siblings, and many of them, it took years to get news if they survived or not. I mean, one of the heartbreaks was just the not knowing what things were happening. I do remember when my grandmother's brother was able to come from the Soviet Union, come from Ukraine, this would have been in the late 80s, which was really hard. It took forever to get the visa. And I do remember the moment they saw each other. I mean, the last moment they had together was she's fleeing the village and leaving her little brother behind. You do have these powerful stories of remembering, you know.
Describe that moment.
Well, you know, I was so young and I was a little embarrassed by the emotion, but everybody was very... broken up, I mean, literally kind of weeping when he got off the plane. And this was in the day where you could go to the airport and be standing there when he walked out of the terminal. And seeing that kind of connection, that the embrace they had, was what you realize we in this country, you know, take for granted that we have the ability to see our family when we want to. We might be, you know, disenfranchised from them or kind of on the outs with people and voluntarily decide not to see people. But when you really can't, when you're forced by political forces to not see the people you loved, to go decades without seeing your little brother, I remember feeling really grateful to live here. And on the way home, we stopped at a grocery store, and my great-uncle, my grandma's brother, made us take all these pictures of him in the dog food aisle and in the lunch meat aisle. And he was amazed at what we lived with. And I remember it being, you know, 13 years old and realizing, like, he had never seen a grocery store stocked with whatever you wanted. You know, it was, and he took pictures pushing the lawnmower. It was really amazing to go, you know, behind the Iron Curtain, which was still up at the time, and just seeing, like, you know, I remember coming away feeling very lucky that I would never be kept from my family, or hopefully never kept by my family by politics.
Dean Bacopoulos, is there anything that Ukrainian Americans are able to do more than watch from this side of the world and hope this ends peacefully? Are there any actions being taken by Ukrainian Americans?
There are, and if you go on Facebook and Twitter, there's probably a ton of them. I don't have the links handy, but I do know there's a fund being started for the family of families that the protesters killed as one of the most immediate things being set up for people, because many of these protesters who were killed by snipers and by police, like I said, they were parents. They were there supporting their country, trying to fight for their country, but they weren't professional activists, right? They weren't giving their life over to this necessarily. So there's funds being set up where you can donate to those families. It's a very immediate thing you can do.
Thank you very much for this conversation, Dean Bacopoulos, Ukrainian-American and writer-in-residence at Grinnell College. It's been fascinating to hear your reflections and thoughts on this crisis.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Dean Bacopoulos mentioned the emotion and meaning behind Ukrainian music. As we go to break, let's hear an old song that's from part of Ukraine where his grandmother was from. Dean says it was also recently used in Kiev and played when the first protesters were killed. Here's part of the English translation. It's the story of a woman whose son leaves to fight. Hey, see the mallard floating on the Tisson River. Mama, do not scold me. You will scold me at the wrong hour. I don't know where I will die. I will die in a foreign land. Who will choose my grave? Strangers will choose my grave. Will you not grieve then, my mama? How will I not grieve then, my son? You once rested on my heart. You rested on my heart.
Тож ми буде брати яму? Хто ж ми буде брати яму?
Ей, виберуть ми чужі люди.
Coming up, one of the world's leading experts on wealth, poverty, and the gap that separates them, World Bank economist and development specialist Branko Milanovic. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
Ти ж на моїм серцю лежиш.